travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. Today's special guest is Al Ewing. You know him as the writer of The Immortal Hulk and Sword. He is now the writer for The Defenders, Venom, and We Only Find Them When They're Dead. Now join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Ewing. Thank you so much for coming to Traversing the Stars.
Hello. Happy to be along, I guess.
I'm a big fan of yours. You are an exceptional writer. Hulk series was so well done. I mean, that was a classic run.
Thank you very much. I'm glad people enjoyed it as much as they did.
It seems like even more than the last time we spoke that you really have become even more important of a writer in the industry right now. Like your star is even bigger than it was before.
I mean, I'm not good at measuring these things. From the inside of it, I just feel like I'm kind of, I don't know how important I am in terms of, you know, the actual making of decisions. I'm glad, from my point of view, I'm just glad it's still at work. But, you know, I kind of try to sort of, I'm definitely thinking more than I was this time last year in terms of what's coming next in the creator-owned sphere.
Do you find that you now have more freedom to tell the stories you want to tell than you have before?
I think there's a sort of plateau of freedom that you reach. Because I guess I was under the impression that, like, you know, having sort of proved myself in certain ways, I'd, you know, be able to reach a little further next time. But I think when you're working for the sort of the big companies, you know, with the big characters that make big money, the big Hollywood characters especially, there's a kind of, you know, these do not belong to me. I can, you know, I can have the greatest idea in the world, and if that idea doesn't, you know, hit the spot with, in some cases, with people who I will never see or meet, then, you know, it's sort of off the table. And that's kind of just how it is. You know, I'm not complaining. But at the same time, I'm sort of like starting to think about what I could do with, you know, with those breaks off. And it is an exchange, because the nice thing about working with, you know, the big Marvel superheroes is that they come with this sort of cultural energy, this kind of cultural cachet, that it's sort of easy to discount that and say that, like, oh, no, just, you know, do your own characters. But it's like when you're dealing with something with 60 years of history behind it, you can really kind of, you can really use that weight in places like in Guardians. When we did Guardians, we made a lot out of some stuff from the 70s. And that wouldn't have landed if I was doing a similar story with, you know, a character that I kind of had full control over. Because I would be just creating this character for the first time now. And, you know, they wouldn't have that history. And they wouldn't have that weight, and they wouldn't have that energy. So, you know, you are trading that away. But at the same time, I'm having ideas now that I don't think I can. And, you know, I'm happy to be proved wrong, but I don't think I can do them at Marvel right now. And so, you know, that's just kind of like, okay, well, I'll keep those and kind of see if I can make them work. And sometimes, you know, some of these are sort of very structural ideas or sort of formalist ideas. Some of them are you make up a character like Batman to do the things that Batman can do, and then, you know, the Batman company buys them. So, you know, I'm sort of starting to see the boundaries of what can be done. And it's fine. There's still, you know, I like boundaries. There's still a lot that can be done in the space, and I think limitations are sort of good for you to an extent, but at the same time, there are directions I'm wanting to stretch a little that are like, yeah, okay. So in that sense, I'm thinking like, one example, which is gonna Because I know people are going to be reading all sorts of stuff. People are going to be like making up little stories, making up little, you know, motivations, which, you know, I kind of hate when people do that, because, like, you know, maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong, but if I wanted to tell you, I'd tell you. But also, it's like, we only find them when they're dead. The covers of that, the way the title dominates the image, in a way that Simone just eats up. It's like, you know, he really loved the idea and loved the idea of working within it. And then, you know, if you saw in like volume two, he was really just playing with it and like really kind of turning the words into tools in the image. And he's still doing that in a way that's just absolutely phenomenal. We're just working on, starting to work on book three now. But that's the kind of thing you need to have, like, a lot of conversations if you want to kind of break out of the mold of this is what a cover looks like. And I mean, at Boom, it was like a couple of conversations. It was like, I want to do this. Are you sure? Are you sure though? Okay, we'll do it. Oh, brilliant. It worked. And, you know, that was kind of like, I didn't get much pushback at all. It was like, you know, are you sure this is going to work, was like the extent of it. And, you know, how do we make this work in a context where, like, we do need a little symbol up in the top. And, you know, I was thinking of this as well, like, you know, okay, and we put a little something there in the top left of the cover, so that on the rack or a spinner or, you know, arranged in a certain way, people can still immediately tell what it is.
So when you've been, so since you have worked with Marvel and you have demonstrated an enormous amount of success writing their characters, do they trust you with greater risk than they may have a year or two ago?
Sometimes it depends. It depends on what I want to do. Sometimes they do. Sometimes not so much. It's, you know, it is what it is. I think in terms of Defenders, I know we're going to be talking about that lately, I've been able to do stuff that's kind of, I honestly thought I'd be getting an email from somebody about, just in terms of like, oh, you're changing everything. You know, you in this miniseries, you're kind of changing everything about how like the Marvel Universe works. And it's like, I assumed, you know, I'd at least have a conversation of like, Defenders is another one because that took a little break for the pandemic. I mean, this issue that's just about to come out, which is probably the most kind of cosmic and hallucinatory one yet. That was the one I was expecting to like get an email going, like, you've gone too far. It's too cosmic. We've got to rewrite all of the, you know, we've got to rewrite all the rule books now, all the stuff. But no, they were fine with it. They don't need to do that. You can change everything in the fictional Marvel universe. You can turn it upside down. You can turn it on its head. But what you can't do is change the shape of Robert Downey Jr.'s mustache. that is where I'd say. You know, you start noticing the walls, you start noticing the sort of bars of the cage.
The Defenders miniseries, I mean, that's a pretty ballsy miniseries. I mean, not only beyond really Doctor Strange, it's a mostly unknown cast. It's characters that most people are not familiar with. It's dealing with concept pre-616, it sounds like, you know, for the most part.
Yeah.
It's a very daring series, and I guess from an outsider's perspective, it's almost surprising, make sure this comes out the right way, that it got greenlit because of how daring, you know, of a risk that series seems to be on the surface.
I mean, I think it's like, it was always meant as a kind of an artistic project, if that makes sense, because it's like, and I mean that as in, it kind of came about because it's long ago that we started this now. I'm trying to remember, but I'm pretty sure that me and Javier teaming up again was baked in, like, from the start. This was going to be kind of like our book. And I kind of, I put the plot down, like, with him in mind, but also wanting to tie up a lot of stuff. I wanted to tie up the stuff with the Masquerader, because that had been dangling for a while. I wanted to do more with the concept of the previous multiverses from Ultimates. I thought, you know, I mean, with Javier, you know, we kind of like back and forth on the team and sort of I've got to thread this needle a little carefully, because there are sort of announcements to come. So I can't sort of and spoilers, so I can't kind of go too far into the ins and outs behind the scenes. But in terms of the sort of cosmic nature of it, it couldn't be any other way, because like Javier as an artist, he just needs that level of kind of scope and space, and you can't cage it. And like you know, for my part of it too, it's like an artistic project for me as well. It's sort of, it's me wanting to explore a whole bunch of the kind of themes and thoughts that I've had about, you know, the Marvel Universe and how it operates, and sort of putting it all together in that sense. But yeah, in terms of the sort of, I think we've got one more thing going for us, which is that it's something I've sort of used a lot in the past, in that at a certain level of scope, at a certain cosmic level, it matters less. So, I mean, I've kind of created like multiverses before the main Marvel multiverse and after. And, you know, they're kind of, they're massive, and they're sort of, there's a lot there, and there's a lot kind of being... But in terms of how much this affects, say, Daredevil, it absolutely doesn't. It's like, you know, this doesn't change the day-to-day life of Peter Parker one little bit. So I'd probably have a tougher time pitching something like Chip's doing with this Devil's Reign thing. Because that changes the day-to-day life of... a bunch of Marvel heroes. It's like when you read in the newspaper, or you see on Twitter that like scientists are now, you know, extremely sure that there are parallel universes. I can't remember the last bit of news on this, but I'm pretty sure, you know, scientists have sort of confirmed parallel universes, confirmed universes where time runs backwards. And it's like, that must be what it's like when, you know, the average Marvel citizen is like, oh yeah, 7 previous multiverses confirmed. They had a fight. You know, the average Marvel citizen is going to like read that newspaper and go like, oh wow, what a great thing to think about for 10 minutes on the commute. It's like, in terms of the riskiness of it, it's almost more a sort of artistic risk, in that it's like, you know, we're going so far out with this in terms of our tone, and, you know, in terms of like not using the big heroes really, apart from Strange. There's that element of kind of asking the readers to come along with us, and they have. But in terms of like, oh, we want to change the entire model, not really. We're just like tinkering with the backstory a little bit. And in ways that, okay, in terms of tinkering with the past of the universe, I think it would be a bigger thing to say that like Captain America was never frozen in ice. Or say that like the Submariner we see, the name of the Submariner we see now, was born in the 80s. And he's like the son of the original name of like the 40s and 50s. It's like... You know, that's the kind of thing that to some people might even seem reasonable. But it's like, I feel like I'd have much more trouble getting across the finish line because, you know, even though it feels like it's less important, it's a weird thing. It's a really weird thing, kind of continuity and like what can be done and what can't be done. I mean, I feel like if people are reading Defenders, you really should be. You know, you're on the trip. You know, you're just reading it for the sheer epic, cosmic, you know, poetic nature of it.
Mm.
And maybe, you know, this is going to change the Marvel Universe. I mean, yeah, it is, technically. It absolutely is. But it's like, if you are reading Defenders, I doubt that is your reason for reading.
Mm.
And I mean, I think more people should read it. And if you're not reading it, I think you should. But I think you should read it because it's going to blow your mind in a more kind of almost a more primal sense. And, you know, it's going to kind of, I don't want to turn anybody, you know, I don't want to turn anybody away from the Defenders. I feel like that stuff, all the cosmic heads are going to love it. I think they're going to get a lot out of it. And are going to, especially, you know, this issue that's dropping Wednesday, issue 4, I feel like that kind of Marvel, the cosmically inclined readers are going to be walking, debating that and discussing that and like wanting more from that for, you know.
You know, I think one of the cool things about the series, and one thing I've enjoyed about it, it feels like one of the primary themes of the series is about about transformation as like a primary theme, because a lot of the characters have been altered or affected by cosmic forces, such as, you know, you had Cloud affected by the cosmic cube. You have, you know, the change in heart, you do the gamma rays. It's kind of like a symbolic aspect of the series that you're trying to impart to the reader?
I mean, I guess so, yeah. It's kind of like, at a certain level, the kind of the metaphors sort of almost kind of get past me, in that, like, it's hard to describe. It's like, I don't kind of map out what all the metaphors are and like what everything means. Sometimes something kind of feels on a gut level like, you know, the right move, like the kind of the poetic choice. And then I'll kind of take a second look at it and I'll see all these multiple meanings coming out of it. But there's definitely a lot of stuff about sort of transformation. I mean, the whole thing is kind of like a journey. It's almost like the LSD trip as like the journey through, you know, the journey to somewhere to kind of bring something back. It's kind of like that because there's sort of strange kind of created, if you go back and look at issue 1, Strange sort of creates the threat that sends them all on their journey by deciding to go on the journey. He sort of hears about something. You know, at this point, the team are just kind of on this ongoing journey that, like, I guess we're going to see what they bring back from it. But, like, each of them in turn, well, you know, at least they kind of gets the opportunity for one. I don't want to sort of limit what readers find in there. I kind of feel like it's almost the job of a book like this to be a sort of bucket where, you know, you reach in and you kind of root around and you see what's there for you. Like a lucky dip. So I don't want to sort of say this is the reading, you know, this is everything I meant to say, because like I might be cutting somebody off from a reading that really means something to them. I found that a lot with Loki. There are a few things that I was like, you know, after the fact, as is always the case, there are a few things where I look back and go, oh, I wouldn't have done it that way. You know, I'd have I'd have finessed it very slightly. I'd have made it, you know, because there was a bit in there that was, you know, the sort of implication, especially that Loki died for reals, and, you know, it was like a new Loki. In issue 13, that implication really, it was very painful for a lot of people. I got a lot of kind of, I got some flack for that, which, you know, deserved. But the thing is that it's like, and, you know, for a long time I was like, oh, well, if I had it all again, I'd go back and I'd make it, you know, I'd make it clear that this was just the sort of, you know, I'd do it differently, I'd finesse it. But then I, you know, I've spoken to people since then, and I've spoken to people who were just like, no, that bit there, that really spoke to me, and that really kind of, you know, don't read this into it because, you know, it's not what I meant. What I meant is this, blah, blah, blah. Let me break it all down for you. Let me give you my notes, you know, let me give you the author's notes. Because it's like that could be kind of closing off what somebody really kind of needs to, a revelation that somebody needs to kind of get for themselves.
Mm.
And I feel like with that approach comes almost like, I almost feel like the reader has a kind of responsibility to sort of, you know, what you find and hear is yours also kind of thing. Oh no, I'm rambling. I should mention for the benefit of the listeners that I did have my booster yesterday. So this is me at my most kind of like tripping. I'm literally working through these concepts as I'm saying.
It's absolutely no worries. The miniseries of Defenders, is that something that is setting the stage for a later ongoing, or is this a very self-contained series?
This is again heading into the territory of like, you know, I couldn't possibly comment kind of thing, the old House of Cards thing. In that, if I answer that question truthfully, I'd be sort of making an announcement about a future plan.
Gotcha.
Or maybe not.
Which
maybe
is okay.
Not. It's not super okay. I feel like there's definitely a kind of a time and a place for dropping announcements, and like, you know, I'd get in trouble if I answered that question honestly. Oh. So, you know, maybe there's more Defenders coming, maybe not. Who knows? I mean, actually, look, I will say the answer to that question is to be found in the current series of Defenders. So, you know, Defenders fans, keep reading. I think it's the most diplomatic way I can say this. That'll please Marvel.
No, I totally understand. I wouldn't want you to get into any trouble with Marvel. It's a very big empire to piss off. I wouldn't want that to happen. Well, one thing, the other project you're working on, obviously, you're the co-writer of Venom.
Yes.
At Ram V.
Yeah.
Now, how does that collaboration work between you guys?
Okay. Well, it's kind of like a band in that we're sort of, it's the story of Dylan and Eddie, and Ram writes all the Dylan stuff, and I write all the Eddie stuff. Aside from if Eddie appears in the Dylan issue, Ram kind of takes care of that, and then I'll go in like after the fact, and I'll kind of, you know, I might make a couple of tweaks, I might just leave as is, but like the same is true of Dylan. You know, if Dylan appears in like an Eddie issue, Rob's gonna sort of check my work there. But essentially it divides neatly into I tackle Eddie and Rob tackles Dylan. And what that means in terms of this first arc is that there's a pretty, because what we wanted to do was A, really introduce Dylan. We're kind of like, we've just come from, you know, 200 issues of Eddie Brock, give or take a little Flash Thompson. You know, we got a new somebody in the Venom suit. we need to show what they're up against, who they're up against, what their life is like, kind of. So what that boils down to is the first arc is very much a Dylan-centric arc, but it's tops and tails with Eddie stuff. I wrote half of issue one. And then issue five, we kind of end the first trade, first album, with like some uninterrupted Eddie, and that's already been solicited. And from there on, it's a lot more back and forth.
Mm.
There was some sort of behind the scenes requirements as well, because I needed a bit of time to kind of finish Hulk up and get another couple of bits and pieces in place. So it was kind of good to not have to worry immediately about issue two. But also for all the other reasons. I mean, it just works better. The way it's coming out, there's a thing. Well, we just got through sending issue four off to the press. I believe that's going out today. And there's stuff in that that is... We did a lot of back and forth thing about it. I'm very much, you know, I'm not sort of, yeah. That was an issue where sort of, I'm actually not sure I can finish that sentence without dropping a big bomb. I actually don't believe I can do that. I think the only way I can finish that sentence is to say read Venom 4. But that's a kind of biggie in terms of the structure of it.
Well, can you answer this? For new readers of Venom, I mean, obviously you said your series comes after 200 issues of Venom and obviously the King in Black miniseries by Donny Cates. Can a new reader understand the Venom series without carrying the weight of the other series that that they have not maybe gone back and read those?
Yeah, I think so. I think you can get everything you need from the recap page, context clues, and in issue one, there's a lot of, you know, we see Eddie describing his life as, you know, this cosmic protector who can send his mind into kind of all these different alien bodies. Yeah, and we see, you know, Dylan's life, what he's up to. And we kind of see, you know, we get a sense from the context is that there was like an original Venom symbiote. And here he is. So I think it's not a case of like... we're definitely continuing on. So there is that sense of continuation, but I feel like the context clues are so strong that a smart new reader can kind of, and you know, if you're reading comics, you know, you've got it. You know, if you know how to read a comic, you've got it.
Yeah.
That's the level, you know, do you know how to read a comic? is this your first ever comic of all of them? You know, in which case, no, even then, I feel like the context is pretty good. I feel like we do the job. No, I think a new reader, somebody who is not used to Venom, somebody who's just coming in, I think they're gonna pick up real fast what the whole thing is about. Because they're gonna, even if they don't know. If they don't know about the ins and outs of, you know, the Venom symbiote and like the history of the Venom symbiote, you know, we kind of explain the King Black deal. And then you've got a book about, you know, a father, a son, the kind of the back and forth there. You know, the idea of sort of having these vast powers and responsibilities and letting it get on top of you, overconfidence in the face of power, kind of. There's all of these themes that are just sort of, you know, they're kind of classic themes. I don't. You know.
So, I mean, Eddie Brock definitely has concerns with his son bonding with the Venom symbiote. Is the concern, would you say, more due to his experience with Venom and maybe a trust issue with the Venom symbiote? Or is it a trust issue with his son getting the powers and responsibility?
I mean, we'll see the exact reason. Again, we'll see the exact reason for the don't bomb with the symbiote thing. Because Eddie sort of gives this as, on the phone, Eddie sort of gives this as a hard rule without kind of like, but I think, you know, readers are going to learn the why of that. And again, it's that issue four. And then as we go, we'll kind of, that'll sort of give you a hint of where that came from. I think to avoid dropping spoilers and to avoid kind of laying out, you know, what we're planning in too much detail, all I'll say is that Eddie has good reasons to tell them not to bond with the symbiote. You don't fully know what those are yet, but you will.
Now, coming off the King in Black miniseries, Eddie Brock has basically become a symbiote god.
Oh, yeah.
Is it challenging to try to come up with a threat big enough to be worthy of the new version of Eddie Brock, considering, once again, King in Black and the damage done in that series with that antagonist, and obviously Eddie bested him.
It's that Null was a huge threat. In terms of coming up with the antagonist and the enemy of this one, the thing is that I knew how Donnie was going to end the book. I knew what the end of King and Black looked like, and I knew where Eddie was going to be. And honestly, the new antagonist for Eddie is... that was the first thing that popped into my head. Because it's sort of... It was very much a case of like, okay, if Eddie is this big now, then he could take on something like this. It was that sort of like immediate kind of putting together of the pieces. I think there's a slight, and it's more of a general event thing, which is how can we imperil the Earth? How can we keep imperiling the Earth? Because it's like, we've done it a bunch of different ways. So I think that's always going to be a concern, is, you know, how to do a thing that hasn't been done. And I almost feel like that's the bigger concern with than like kind of how can Eddie fight something bigger? There's always something bigger. The challenge is something newer. So the one thing I was worried about, which I don't think anybody hit us with this one, but there's a bad guy in the new Venom series called Meridius, who is sort of on the sidelines in the background and kind of very, very sort of mysterious, very kind of, and as new issues drop, we'll find out more and more about their deal and how they work. What I was worried about was that people would get to the end of issue one and go like, oh, it's Null again. And no, it's because it's not Null again. It's very, very far from that. And I mean, you know, visually me and Brian kind of like worked together to sort of go in a different tonal direction. Meridius takes a lot from almost classical sculpture. He's got that face that's, I think I found a bust of Alexander the Great and was like, yeah, no, I think he's got this face. I think he's got the face, not a face like Alexander, a face like a statue.
Mm.
Like, he's this sort of, like, you know, almost perfect and inhuman. And you know, we're gonna play a lot with that, play a lot with what Meridius can do. But it was kind of, I think Brian did a really good job of, like, tonally making it different from Null, because that was my big fear, that people were gonna think that we were gonna do the same thing again. And it's like, no, nothing further from the truth. We are. This is going to be something, I think, completely different to, I would say, any Venom story there has been. Which is a big thing to say, but I think it's true.
Does having Dylan involved in the story help to ground the Eddie Brock part of it? In other words, because once again, there's so much scope in that part.
Yeah,
and like I said, he has basically transitioned to God of the symbiotes. Does it help having this Dylan in the story for the readers?
100% yes. And I think this is why I'm really glad to be working with Ron, because, you know, as you've seen, if you've seen his other work, he's really good at, like, grounded, involved, emotional narratives. And, you know, he's like, I was really conscious that, like, the Eddie side of the story is kind of, it's by design, it's up in some very kind of out there territory. It's you know, we leave Eddie in the first issue kind of at the end of time. We're kind of gonna, when issue 5 comes out, we're gonna get even more kind of unmoored from the present day, I guess is the way to put it. It's I don't want to spoil anything, but, you know, Eddie's gonna meet a lot of interesting people and go through a lot of interesting stuff. But we also need to kind of the reader to have somebody whose problems are real, and that issue 1. Where, like, Eddie's kind of fighting, you know, Skrull pirates on the spaceship. And then we come home and we see how Dylan's been living. It's just pizza boxes everywhere. And, like, you know, he's been having a terrible time because his dad's just not there. His dad's just checked out. And I feel like that was a really good moment, kind of grounding, I think, the new readers and readers who kind of are very used to Eddie. They're going to kind of, there'll be that desire to see what Eddie's doing, but I think Dylan sort of grabs them just with the sort of the down-to-earth nature of the story and the kind of the realness of what he's into. I just feel Dylan's half of things kind of, it's the one that sort of grabs the reader and kind of grounds them before, you know, Eddie returns and we get into the narrative and we get into, you know, some of this bigger stuff.
You know, I think one thing that you do so well with your stories, not just, you know, Defenders, Venom, We Only Find Them When They're Dead, you do so well handling scope. I mean, all these stories, I think there's one common thread of these stories is that is the scope in which you're writing in, and it's immense.
Thank you. It is something I like doing. I like doing vast, you know, vast scope stories. I guess that's from a kind of things like the Infinity Gauntlet. I remember as a kid. My first Marvel comic ever. If we're talking about scope, the first Marvel comic that I ever read was Secret Wars, which is, like, you know, it starts with an entire galaxy being destroyed, and, you know, the heroes, like, watching impotently from their vast space thing, as, you know, Galactus, who we've kind of seen, is a big guy, and we've been told his deal. goes out to kind of confront the Beyonder and just gets swatted away like a fly. And, you know, we're really made to see it. We really see how tiny, you know, this guy who was just like a big foot in the background until this up until now. And I mean, this is the guy, you know, I'm picking this up, it's like 8 foot 9.
Right, right.
And, you know, and I've got a rough idea who Spider-Man is, I've got a rough idea who the Hulk is. You know, I know who the big superheroes are by osmosis, but like seeing them all together in a room, dealing with this. And it's like there's a real, and you know, every Secret Wars, you read it again now, and it's just, it's almost funny. It's really easy to kind of take the mickey out of like the way that every room is the size of 27 Pittsburghs, and like, you know, every building they're in. You know, there's a bit where like,
yeah,
Captain America, you know, the heroes of family headquarters of Captain America are like, oh, it's as huge as 200 pentagons. Like, oh, well, we'll have a meeting in that room we found on the 287th floor. And it's like, oh, what, that one room? that one room really stood out. And it's, you know, it's not like, oh, yeah, okay, we'll meet that back down at the entrance.
Yeah.
Or like, for God's sake, don't split up and be here for the rest of our lives. It's like,
yeah.
So there's that sense that, you know, both things are like vast, but also the sense of distance is just lost. And, you know, I was just absorbing all this stuff as a kid. This is what the Marvel Universe looked like to me. Is, you know, my exact drawing, just fabulous, beautiful structures, and then Jim Shooter telling you how big they are. But like, and then, you know, moving from that to like the Infinity Gauntlet, which just ramps up and up and up. It ramps up, you know, there's this battle where all of the heroes die. And then it's like, oh, but never mind, true believer, because here come the embodiments of everything, the actual gods. And it's like, yeah, it's all these sort of giant, weirdly kind of, you know, there's this bit where it's like, it's just this roll call of every kind of quote unquote cosmic idea a writer has had up to this point.
Mm.
And they're all kind of getting together in the same room. And it's, so it's like, you know, there's Galactus there and the Molecule Man and like order and chaos and the in-betweener and like love and hate and a whole bunch of the Stranger. So, you know, a Jack Kirby concept from my back. And like, so it's just this mishmash of entities in this white void. And I was just, you know, blown away by that because it was just like, it felt kind of real in terms of just the mashing together of it. The kind of, oh yeah, this is how a cosmology, you know, a sort of cosmology or a sort of pantheon would develop, just out of all of these sort of different stories being mashed together into a shared universe. These sort of, you know, that's how you end up with like a pantheon of gods. So kind of seeing all of these weirdly mismatched, you know, I mean, Molecule Man's just sort of standing in the middle of them, and he's just this little flea in comparison.
Mm.
And then you've got, you know, the Living Tribunal, who I think Bill Everett came up with him visually. And he just looked bizarre in that first appearance.
Mm.
And, you know, there's a kind of, I guess that's the Marvel cosmology I kind of want to add to.
Mm.
And I don't want to get mired in that sort of, I'm very conscious that like that pantheon from Infinity Gauntlet, you know, the White Void with all the people, to a lot of people, that's sort of, oh, that's how it is. There's like, freeze it there. That's, you know, that's the status quo. And it's like, no, that came to be because a whole bunch of people kept adding stuff. And like, so I just started adding stuff and adding stuff and adding stuff. And like, I'd come up with something, I'd throw it in there because it sounded cool. Like, you know, the first sure. And then somebody else would do something. I'd sort of try to kind of make it all fit together.
Mm.
And to a certain extent, I think, I think it's that balance between trying to make it all fit together because the connections are cool and not getting too bogged down in those connections. So, like, I mean, before I, you know, I'm not really on Twitter anymore. I just kind of, I had a few just bad days and didn't feel like telling Twitter about them. And, like, basically, they got really easy just not to come back. And also I had this thing of like, well, you know, every time I post on there, that's a load of ad revenue that I'm making for Jack Dorsey or whoever has now replaced him. And like, generally when I create content, I get paid. So, you know, there's an element of that. But also I just, you know, anyway, I'm not on Twitter anymore for various reasons. You know, occasionally I'll go on and make a big announcement, but aside from that, I don't touch it. But when I was there, the number one question I would be asked is, how does Marvel Cosmic Continuity work? And the worst form that question took was like, is this character who I'm really invested in tougher than this character? And it's usually Oblivion. It comes down to Oblivion.
Yeah.
Who's the guy with the tablecloth on his face who is and I remember when he turned up, he was in that the Iceman miniseries, which was good. But like it's, you know, I kept getting asked about it. And it's like, that's sort of where the kind of the cosmology of it all will sort of leave you in the end if you're not careful. So I do like drawing connections, but I'm sort of aware that in a sense I'm kind of writing on the sand. But at the same time, it's nice, you know, it's nice to sort of, if I can sort of build a structure that's kind of good enough for other people to use, that's a nice achievement.
Yeah, it kind of feels like a very similar way in which you're writing in the cosmic level on Defenders. Feels like you are creating your own cosmic mythology in your book by Boom, We Only Find Them When They're Dead.
Yeah, that. I mean, that's just the one book, so it's much easier. I don't have to worry about what somebody else is going to do, because there is nobody else. It's me and Simone.
There's a great line, I think, in your book, We Only Find Them When They're Dead, one of the issues, where it says, in the service of God, anything is justified. And it kind of gives you the sense of a story where people are literally harvesting gods. It's a very interesting statement, I think, for a character to make.
I mean, I should explain for listeners. So far, at time of broadcast, We Only Find Them Where They're Dead kind of happens across two periods of history. In the book one is set when these gods are being harvested, and book two is set around 50 years later. After the harvesting has stopped and worshippers of the gods have sort of taken over the colony from book one. So the character speaking that line is at least outwardly a very sort of fundamentalist person, a kind of hardcore true believer. And also, you know, the person saying that line is also in the middle of, is that from issue 9?
Yes.
Yeah, it is in the middle of, it sure looks like he's from Mexico. So, you know, I couldn't possibly he might turn things around in issue 10. But from everything readers have seen up till issue 9, it does look like, you know, those words might be in service of. So it's, on the one hand, it's like, it is an interesting statement, and it's sort of like an interesting kind of thing to throw in there. On the other, it's like, I don't want that quote to sort of occur out of its context, because I think the context is part of the kind of, there were similar attitudes expressed in the Hulk run. There were definitely characters like Fortan in that who kind of expressed that, you know, for a particular cause, anything could be justified and certain things became necessary. And we've seen it in We're the Only Thunderman That Dead. That, like, when the gold worshippers took over the colony, you know, terrible acts were committed. There were massacres. And, you know, that was seen at the time as a sort of necessary sacrifice for God, necessary to gain control. So, like, I think the big difference with fooling around with Marvel cosmology and doing something like When You Find Them is, when you're fooling around with the Marvel cosmology, A, you get to use a whole bunch of ingredients that you didn't cultivate. So I can just find something from, you know, the 90s and chuck it in, or the 50s, and just chuck it in there. And then, you know, you can see if somebody wants to use what you've created. It's this vast collaborative process, which, you know, has its ups and downs. When You Find Them When They're Dead is much more of a closed system, in that, like, I have a pretty strong idea of, like, how the gods operate and, like, what the truth behind these sort of beings, like, outside our own galaxy. You know, I have a pretty strong idea of what that is. And I've talked that over with Simone, and, you know, we've talked that over with Eric. Is everything. And it's like, we're all now kind of on the same page with it. And it's like, this isn't going to affect a different book. And I don't have to kind of consider elements from other books. Everything is in the one place. And also, When You Find Them When They're Dead is 15 issues long. As big from the start. It's 3 books, 5 issues, telling one story over 3 time periods. And once that is done, that story at least will be over. We might end up telling other stories in the same universe. That's certainly possible. Simone, as co-creator, as, you know, the other half of it, has absolute freedom, as far as I'm concerned, to go off and develop any of the worlds that he has designed and he has created the visual look of, and made suggestions about, you know, how it operates culturally. He can go off and do more stuff in those worlds, you know, and, like, bring somebody else in. I'd be fine with that. Or, you know, we might want to come back to it in however long, if I have another idea I want to do and I could persuade Simone to draw it. You know, that is also a possibility. But for now, in terms of this story, you know, it is so long and it is contained. And that is not the case. That's far from the case at Marvel, because, you know, Marvel continues. Marvel goes on forever. And, you know, part of the fun of a book like Defenders is kind of taking this idea that the Marvel Universe will just continue long after, you know, any of the people who originated it have died. You know, long after, like, you or I have died, it will still be going. There's, you know, short of the collapse of the entire system of capital that we currently enjoy, you know, short of the collapse of our current civilization to the extent that, like, Even then, I'm pretty sure in some form there will still be like Spider-Man stories, because not so much in a kind of although I'm sure, you know, I'm sure somebody somewhere will be telling Spider-Man stories about a campfire, but like, you know, someone will always own Spider-Man. Someone will always want to profit from Spider-Man. There will always be Spider-Man stories, you know, like, but yeah, I thought it might be fun in Defenders to kind of create, to go along with Marvel's Infinite Futures, sort of also give them like an infinite past. Like to say that there was a whole bunch before, you know, before Marvel began, you know, there was a whole bunch more of it that you can go back and visit. And you know, here are all these places you can have fun in if you want.
Well, one question I did have about We Only Find Them When They're Dead that connects to all of that is that, once again, playing with the idea of gods and the scope of your story, are you also discussing a little bit or comparing faith in gods with loyalty or to leaders? Are they a similar thing that you're trying to kind of draw a line?
I mean, if you find it there, I definitely think there's... and again, this is, I don't know if, I feel like issue 10 is out this week. So I don't want to be all like, I don't want to spoil that before it hits the stats.
Well, just but to let you know, the interview will come out probably next week. So it would already be out.
Okay. Probably. So it's probably, this is probably coming out after issue 10. I mean, I'll be fairly, like non-spoilery with it anyway. But definitely we're seeing in the context of the current arc, the middle book, leaders using faith in the gods to stoke belief in them. And we're kind of seeing how that's used. I feel like certainly with the gods in there is that link between, because another way this is different from Marvel is that if you have a god in Marvel, they're gonna talk, they're gonna say something. you know, whether it's Thor, even up to the gods being dead in When You Find Them When They're Dead, is that they cannot speak. They can only be spoken for. So you have a number of leaders and a number of kind of people of power speaking for them, speaking about them, speaking around them, kind of using them as props, essentially, to kind of assigning them meaning and then extrapolating upon it. And, you know, I'm not saying that we won't eventually, part of the quest to find the live one is to see what they might have to say, which is, you know, another part of what it's about is the kind of, is God this sort of unreachable thing that everybody tells you, I know what this is all about. You know, it's quite an agnostic, it comes from a very agnostic place, and that I kind of had the atheism, you know, slapped out of me by the new atheists of the noughties. That was an extremely wearing time. But yeah, so, you know, I'm kind of, I do not know. And obviously, you know, growing up in the 80s in the UK, we got told a lot. And I imagine the same is true across the pond. You know, people get told a lot, like, what God thinks, what God wants. You don't actually get to speak to them.
Right.
You know, you get to speak to the secretary. You get to speak to the grand vizier. So yeah, there's definitely a side of that, but also, you know, it's also about the kind of desire to to have a personal connection and what that desire might leave in its wake. I mean, the actual George Malick is, after the first book, you know, not to spoil it for people who haven't read yet, but after the first book, he's kind of out of the story. And we're sort of, we see the people that he's left behind. Saying that, there's a lot of stuff. I don't want to kind of lay it all out, what it's about.
Mm.
You know, I'd like people to kind of find their own things in it. And you know, we'll kind of, it's, I've got the ending in mind, and I know what form the next book takes. You know, I know where that's going. So yeah, it's a case of, you know, we'll see if people like the ending.
So you're saying, so we only finally did is 15 issues.
Yep.
Defenders is 5. What other project then are you going to be working on, especially creator owned, after that one?
Well, there's two in my head right now. One I'm thinking might be what replaces When You Find Them. The other I was thinking in a sort of Kickstarter-y direction, and I'm sort of rethinking that a little bit because I don't want it to be an NFT. But yeah, I had an idea for something quite major. In terms of the level of organization, sort of, yeah, and this would be something that I don't really, I'm working out if I want to do it through a publisher or sort of a crowdfunding service. You know, how to go about putting it together. So, you know, it's like, I've got one thing bubbling up, and, you know, Christmas is like the time to take a bit of time to myself and kind of bang both of these things into like a discernible shape. But definitely like something that'll be, I think, out through the normal channels, and something that's kind of outside those channels. But, you know, I don't really want to be kind of dropping any big stuff. You know, I don't want to serve the wine before it's time, kind of thing.
No, I totally understand.
Yeah, but there is, you know, there's stuff in the pipeline. There's a few, there are projects in the pipeline still. Again, you know, the announcements are sort of gaining speed. They're coming down the track. There will come a time when, like, I could say, I might even come back to it for it, when I can say, like, hey, this is happening.
Well, when those ideas are ready to be discussed, I hope you do come back to discuss
them. No, absolutely will do.
Well, Yumi, it was a great pleasure talking with you, sir.
No, thank you.